You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
So, distinguished panelists and participants, my name is Jonas Hofström. I'm the Swedish ambassador to the United States. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you to this, to House of Sweden, and to the seminar, Is There a Convergency Between U.S. and European Policy on Democracy Support? First of all, I would like to thank our co-host, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and International IDEA, for arranging this timely event. I would also like to thank our moderator and panelists for their participation. One of the priorities of Sweden's presidency of the European Union is to strengthen the EU's role as a global actor. We did so end of October at the Council Summit in Brussels when the Lisbon Treaty was finalized. This includes increasing the ability of the European Union to effectively support democratization processes in other parts of the world. An important step was taken when the EU Foreign and Development Cooperation Ministers agreed this week to work together to realize the EU's full potential as one of the most important global actors in the struggle for democracy and human rights. International IDEA greatly contributed to the process, leading up to the joint decision through the project Democracy in Development, Global Consultations on the EU's Role in Democracy Building. I would like to thank Vidar Helgesen, where are you, Vidar? There you are. Secretary Jenner of International IDEA and Mrs. Ingrid Wetterqvist, the director of the project, for all their hard work. The results of that project will be presented here today. I had the pleasure to meet the participants during one of the consultations which took place here in Washington last March with the Organization of American States. The Obama administration seems to be redefining its democracy promotion policies, and the implementation of the Lisbon Treaty is, as we all know, taking shape. We now have an opportunity for greater transatlantic cooperation on democracy support. This issue was raised in February by Sweden's Minister of Development Cooperation, Ms. Gunilla Carlsson, when the Transatlantic Task Force on Development, which she co-chaired together with Jim Colby from German Marshall Fund, was launched here in House of Sweden. I'm looking forward to an even deeper discussion today by the distinguished experts in the panel. I would now like to introduce our moderator, Tom Carruthers, who is Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Mr. Carruthers is a leading authority on democratization and democracy promotion and U.S. foreign policy in general. He has worked on democracy building programs around the world for 20 years, and he has written and edited 8 critically acclaimed books on democracy promotion. Once again, warmly welcome. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much. Well, it's a real pleasure to have cooperated in this event together with the Embassy of Sweden and the Ambassador and his capable staff, as well as International IDEA. You know you're here in Sweden when the principle of transparency is carried all the way through to the podium. And you know, transparency applies to all things in public life, and there's nowhere to hide in Sweden. Pleasure to be here. And somebody was saying, a friend of mine over here, that that they love coming to the Carnegie Endowment for meetings, but it's actually kind of fun to come somewhere different. And so we're delighted that those of you who haven't had a chance to come to Sweden House before are here for the first time, and come back. They do lots of other interesting things as well. The subject of U.S.-European relations and democracy support, at one level, it seems like it should be simple. The United States and Europe clearly share very basic democratic values, and we have for a long time. And during the 1990s, I would argue that in general, there was a feeling of convergence between the United States and Europe, at least partially, on democracy support, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, where Americans and Europeans often worked side by side and together on programs, but also in Africa and Latin America and other parts of the world as well. And it seemed obvious that this should be the trajectory. In this decade, however, the picture became more complicated. Underlying differences, I would say, between the United States and Europe, both in mindset, sometimes in methodology, sometimes underlying philosophy about democracy, came to the fore in a decade in which U.S. policy on democracy promotion unsettled a number of European partners and allies, made them feel that they were in a difficult position in which they did not want to be associated with U.S. efforts, or in which they were being contaminated in some ways by the difficulties and unhappiness and resistance that people felt in the world towards some of the things, at least, that the United States government was doing. And I'd say in the last 5 years or so, we stopped talking and thinking so much together, although, of course, one could point in any number of countries to efforts that continue to proceed side by side and together on the ground. But I would say at the diplomatic level, often in national capitals, there was a great deal of hesitation about this agenda and what it meant as a common platform between the United States and Europe. Now, however, in this year, we have a new opportunity. On the U.S. side, obviously, we have a new U.S. administration, which is, I would say, more open to global cooperation as a general principle, but also specifically with respect to European partners and allies, and is trying to reformulate its policy on democracy promotion in ways that will make it more compatible with a broader international consensus. And then on the European side, we have the fruits of some significant diplomatic efforts that have been undertaken in the last 5 years to build some kind of European framework, consensus, policy principles on democracy that nicely timed for this event. We're just concluded last week in Brussels, the European Council issuing the conclusions that they did on democracy support that we'll be talking about. And so we have a fortuitous moment, in a sense, historically, to get back to the convergence and the sense of positive trajectory that we had in the 1990s. But it isn't self-evident. It doesn't have to happen. It will depend upon the concerted actions of governments and non-governmental organizations that want to make that happen. And I think in order to do that, we need to explore better what it might consist of. And to do that, I think, particularly for a largely U.S. audience here, we need to learn more about the European side and then explore what are, you know, in a sense, similarities and differences in how we do that. So here's how we're going to proceed today. We actually have a slightly complicated structure because it's a complicated subject. We're going to start with a presentation by Ingrid Wedderquist, who I'll introduce in a moment, on this interesting study that International IDEA carried out with the support of the Swedish government and others, I think, on global perceptions of EU democracy support. And we'll do that to help inform ourselves better about how the world is seeing, or parts of the world are seeing, the European Union as a democracy actor, and give ourselves, in a sense, some substance on that subject. Then Ingrid's going to finish. We might take a few questions on that and a bit of a discussion, just briefly. And then I'm going to have a panel come up who I'll introduce once they're up on the podium, and we're going to proceed with some more discussion and presentations from there. So without further ado, let me introduce Ingrid. Ingrid is, I'm happy to say, a longtime friend and colleague, someone I've had the pleasure of working with for, I think, at least 15 years at this point. She's a senior Swedish diplomat who's a career foreign service officer in the Swedish diplomatic service. She has served in Africa as well as in her own capital and other parts of the world. And in recent years, she's been on leave from the diplomatic service and is working at IDEA as a director. And then she led this project on global support or global perceptions of the EU. So Ingrid brings a wealth of both practical experience of her own as well as, I think, an interesting comparative perspective on this subject. And she is going to step up and present the findings. And then I'll hang around and field questions for Ingrid before we proceed on to the main panel. Ingrid?
Thank you very much for giving International IDEA the opportunity to present this project. I hope that the presentation can serve as a backdrop to the discussions and the panel discussions that will follow. This project was essentially conceived to feed in ideas into European policy development, so you won't hear anything of about the United States and its policies in my presentation. I'll try to spend only 10 minutes of your time going through what we set out to do, how we did it, and the major conclusions coming out of that, and share some ideas with you on what we see as possible follow-ups. And since you are well-informed persons based in Washington, you would be able to draw the parallel conclusions on what you see is coming on this side of the Atlantic, and that could then feed into the panel discussion. So the project is called Democracy in Development. and it's based on a series of consultations asking outsiders outside the European Union how they perceive its activities in the area of democracy building, very broadly defined. First of all, just very quickly, a few facts on International IDEA, because it is my experience that in any presentation there are people in the audience who don't know IDEA and therefore don't really get why are we operating on this macro level of policy making. IDEA is an intergovernmental organization. We have 25 member states, and 10 of these are also members of the European Union. There are 5 in Latin America, there are 6 in Africa, and there are 4 others. The focus of the work program is capacity building and knowledge development on elections, political parties, and constitutions, because these constitute a kind of tripod in terms of building the processes and procedures of democracy as a political system. From time to time, we also do things that are in line with this and can complement the core work program. The headquarters are in Stockholm. A council of member states run the institutions, set the budget, and approve the work program, and they are advised by a board of advisors composed of a number of eminent personalities. Vidar Helgesen, who is present and whom you will hear later, is the Secretary General, and core funding comes from the member states. The working principles might be also important to cover very briefly. The production of knowledge is meant to be comparative. We are not advocating any particular solution. And it's non-prescriptive. We produce global public goods, so anyone can use what we're producing, pick it down from the website, and we're also very generous with whatever other materials we produce. It's meant to empower actors in democracy building, be they civil society people, be they academics, researchers, individuals, governments, or other public institutions. And we talk about democracy building. We try to avoid the terminology of promotion, since it carries with it a notion of one-way communication. You promote onto something what you think is good for them. We emphasize the joint activity of strengthening democracy, that you work together. So why this project? Well, International IDEA is the result of a multi-party motion in the Swedish parliament, and actually the mother of this multi-party motion now wears the democracy ambassador hat and is here in the audience. You will hear from her as well. And the Swedish EU presidency was then, of course, a temptation and a window of opportunity not to be resisted for an organization of IDEA in terms of contributing to policy making that could make be of relevance both for Sweden and for the European Union. IDEA has existed actively in 14, 15 years, and therefore now has a track record and a convening power that we thought could be a useful input into this process, building on our friendships in the other regions outside of the European Union. And a number of years of consultations in Brussels showed us that not only is democracy and human rights fundamental values, but they are also referred to in all external relations policies, but with different interpretations. Therefore, there is a confusing situation both inside and outside the Union in terms of what platform is it that we're operating on. What was it that IDEA could contribute with that the 50,000 lobbyists in Brussels could not contribute with? We decided that that would possibly be exploring the perceptions part of this. Perceptions are sometimes provide more of hard facts than what facts do. They are resistant to change. They're very important in how you are able to be successful in relation to your intentions when you engage in democracy building and other activities. So who and when? Sweden agreed to sponsor this. It started 1st of September 2008. We delivered our report 9 months later, so the production time of an ordinary baby. When I shared my concerns in August with the government of the Netherlands of the lack of funding for going back to the people who were kind enough to provide us with the inputs, we also got additional funding from the government of the Netherlands for this exercise. We put together an international team covering the regions we were working with, and the regions were Latin America, Africa, the Arab world, Southeast Asia, and South Asia. And we also were supported by friends of the project of a variety of characters, but most importantly, all the key policy areas in Brussels. So this has not been done behind the back of policymakers in Brussels. They've been on board the project all the time. I think that's part of the impact it's had. It will end 30th of June 2010. We'll spend the rest of the time doing dissemination work and try to encourage others just to move on the findings. This is the simple working hypothesis. The European Union is expressing its intentions in a large number of policy areas. For an the CFSP, the common security and foreign policy is of course most prominent, but also development cooperation, very prominent, combined with enlargement and neighborhood policies. We have mapped the intentions and we analyzed where the democracy references were used and how they were understood. And then we embarked on a series of exercises exploring the perceptions of the partners. As in all human new relations, of course, there is always intentions and perceptions, and there is always a gap. It can be small, it can be big. The question was, is it small or big, and what does it consist of? And the gap, of course, is also the space where you can come forward with policy proposals. How did we do this? We spent the first 3 months before the end of 2008 commissioning a large number of papers to try to trawl through the material and see what is it that's coming forward if you ask people very open questions. Could it be that when it's about supporting democracy, it's actually other things that come in the way? Would it be that if we are asking about the perception on the European Union in this area, when what's coming up is actually arguments on the trade agenda? That would be interesting to explore. This followed with a series of consultations, 5 consultations in the capitals of the regional organizations we chose to cooperate with: the Organization of American States here in Washington, the League of Arab States in Cairo, the African Union in Addis Ababa, ASEAN in Jakarta. We did not manage to have direct cooperation with SAARC, but they turned us to their main think tank, SACEPS, so we also had a consultation in Kathmandu. Many of the people who participated in this were also interviewed. We have interacted with about 300 people who have shared their views on the European Union, and these are people who in one way or another are well-informed interlocutors. And the report then, which is available for you outside on a table, was handed over to the government of Sweden 3rd of July. It's very open-ended questions this project was based on. We did not come with a preconceived theory of what the outcome would be. We tried to ask, what is it that you, our partner, our European partner in ASEAN, consider major challenges to democracy building in your region? What role do you perceive the European Union to play in relationship to these challenges to democracy building? And from there, a kind of triangulation, what would your recommendations be for things to change? What should be dropped? What should be continued? What should be strengthened? What is it that is weak? Where is there a misunderstanding? How can we, in short, make a better fit between your expectations and our intentions and abilities? The results. Europeans, you might know, tend to be rather self-critical, and we live in this consistent feeling that things could be better and we could do a lot better. So to me, at least, it was surprising that the first reaction was always positive. The EU is perceived as a credible partner, quite attractive and reliable, and has a lot of credibility in its own achievements. But as you create an atmosphere of consultations and you move on with this process, then of course the buts turn up. Double standards. Europeans are well aware about this, I think. What applies in one country doesn't apply in another country, and it isn't always a clarity as to why does this happen. There is an incoherence between the policies. What is important for foreign policy might not be important for development policy, and there are no apparent explanations. Disconnect between intentions and perceptions. It might be very well-meant intentions, but they're not perceived as this, and the discussion isn't taken as to why. And there is a disconnect with Europe's own narrative. This was obvious when we had consultations in ASEAN and we got extremely concrete questions on economic integration. How did you guys do it? Portugal, as an example, was a poor country a generation ago. Now it's no longer a poor country. There must be technical solutions to these changes. Are these something that you can share? Well, my team wasn't capable of sharing that, but it was then an obvious indication of some kind of knowledge capital that hasn't been used in the area of democracy building, that has a value and that could be exploited. We trawled through all these interviews, meetings, conferences, papers to try to find out what is it that is really common, strong messages here, and they were surprisingly simple. The EU needs to tap into its own experiences to inform external action in this area. So what is the story of getting rid of military regimes, military solutions to political conflicts in Europe? What were the mechanisms? There is a fantastic quotation in the report, by the way, from a Cambodian MP saying, you got rid of military interventions and you're unable, for us, this is no less than a miracle. But what was your story? How did you do this? The other strong message is that if the European Union is treating democracy as a political system only in its strive to support its development in other parts of the world, they will not succeed. The demand outside of Europe is for raising living standards and for the delivery aspects of democracy. So therefore, a broad understanding of the concept is really important. And if you don't wish to work on such a fluffy definition, at least it's important to state that there are different understandings, and in this particular context, this is what we apply. The other two are more self-evident. Stand by long-term commitments. Democracy doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long-term commitment, also from within. And genuine partnerships are between peers. The traditional donor-recipient relationship isn't very helpful when you actually want to achieve some substance in this area. Five quotations just to show you the kind of language that were used by people we interacted with. Dr. Surin Pitsovan, Secretary General of ASEAN, talking about the European Union as an inspiration. Not a model, they see a different track of development, but an inspiration, and that was also the consultation that yielded most requests for practical advice on how integration was done. Apply a broad understanding of democracy. Social cohesion is a key word in Latin America, and it pops up all the time. It relates very well to the delivery aspects of democracy. The same from Africa, where the language is more social dynamics. Stand by long-term commitments. Our board member has been a recipient of EU development aid and had this concern. She is not alone, and I think this is well known in Brussels and something that the EU needs to work on. Move towards genuine partnerships. From the League of Arab States, the Secretary General Amr Moussa, requesting clear criteria on how the agendas actually can be mutually reinforcing in a different manner. So what next? Inside the European Union, as you heard Ambassador Hafström Rast say, the Council conclusions were adopted this week. They provide a foundation for continued work, and we welcome them very much. Beyond the European Union, what we saw happening when we brought together the regional institutions, the OAS with the African Union, with the ASEAN, with the partners in South Asia, was that they hadn't met on a topic before, and that there were many instances of recognition of similarities in need and agendas, and a wish to further explore and deepening this. So a certain dynamic can be created and sustained in cooperation between the regions, and thereby also considering the European Union a region in this respect. And what we see happening is a group of people in South Asia who've been working on what they have, which is a social charter, now embarking on a project developing a democracy charter. And this is inspired by them through this project meeting those who constructed the African Union Charter on Democracy and those who are being severely tested actually in the OAS on the OAS Democracy Charter. For International IDEA, this project will end 30th of June next year. There is a commitment to continue supporting the interregional process. It will manifest itself in a conference towards the end of 2010. And I think it's also inspired a number of other things. If you wish to know more about what we did, the full publication, which includes five regional chapters, is available on the website and will be printed in December and distributed to those who tell us they would like to receive it. So if you would like to do that, then please register at our table outside. The papers that were informing the consultations will also come up on the website. I think there are about 30 now. We'll in the end have about 80 papers, and they're coming up as we are managed to process them. So this concludes my presentation. Thank you.
Thanks. Why don't you stay here for a minute?
One question, was there much difference between how different regions responded? Or was it fairly similar, Asia, Africa, Latin America, in terms of their perceptions?
What was similar were these four messages that we have presented as generic messages from the project. And there were different tones in different regions. And in a strong impression left with us was that Latin America has a very, very sophisticated discussion on democracy and what it's entailed. They have left the debate on whether democracy or not, and they're talking about what is it that sustains it and how can they deal with the inequalities. The Arab world is a completely different challenge, and you can't really talk democracy. The question is if you can talk political reforms. Certainly what you can talk is developmental challenges, in particular those that are coming from the demographic situation. Very young populations, no labor market, bad public systems of all sorts of kinds. And then maybe the entry point towards democracy there should be a different one than head on. Asia, both Southeast Asia and South Asia, considers the European Union a very distant trade negotiating entity that doesn't really matter in terms of democracy building, and their questions consequently were also related to their own concerns of economic and regional integration, but with the understanding that this also entails a political component sooner or later. So,
did you try to distinguish between people's perception of the EU as a democracy building actor at the diplomatic level and then at the assistance level?
No. We did not have time.
Mm-hmm.
This was 9 months.
No, I'm just curious because, I mean, I know in some places people have had specific interactions with the European Union in terms of a funding relationship, and because there's been problems with some of the funding mechanisms of the European Commission, there's been a certain amount of frustration generated in some non-governmental sectors, for example, that have struggled to deal with the funding mechanisms issue that might give you a specific outcome that would be different from people's perception of the EU as a diplomatic player in a. So I was curious whether you tried to separate out when somebody has a reaction, whether it's based on which level of experience, you know, with the European Union.
The questions we were asking were about the European Union, and we did not define the European Union, so
mm-hmm.
it was up to the respondent to give the examples of their concern.
Mm-hmm.
And the European Union is a body that is not easy to understand,
right.
Not even for people
right.
who are inside it, and has
yeah.
it has very many faces. What is obvious is that support to democracy is a different animal than another kind of development assistance, and that the mechanisms aren't fully in place to have a flexible
mm-hmm.
relationship with those who are working on democracy building.
Yeah. Questions? Two or three questions for Ingrid before we move on? Yes, Mr. Ambassador.
Well, the success story of the European Union is, of course, the large. And the enlargement of the European Union has led us to be champion of two things. First is integration, and the other one is reconciliation. We are the best in the world. And that's why I'm interested to see, because I know that ASEAN has European Union as a role model. Their charter is been looking to the EU founding fathers, and they have adopted a new charter. And of course, if you start with integration, reconciliation, then of course you find support of democracy. So it's very simple if you don't go into all the nitty-gritty things about the European Union. So that's why I'm curious to ask you, did anyone raise reconciliation and integration as two fundamental pillars which will finally lead to better democracy?
That is my interpretation, yes, and in particular from the Asian region. And our conclusion in our recommendation is that the European Union for itself in its interaction could verbalize this as an asset and do that to a much larger extent than what has been done. One is a shyness, I think. We take things for granted. It's like the air we breathe. So it takes others, it takes the perceptions thing to show us that we have something to offer. The other thing, I think, are institutional obstacles. Those who work on this are isolated from people who work on democracy building, for example, and a lot of the internal integration work is completely disconnected from the external relations work.
Yeah, over here. It's coming behind you, Jerry. If you could just introduce yourself.
Jerry Hyman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I was wondering if you could say something about the word partner that you used. You said partners' perceptions of EU intentions. Is that government? Is it non-government? Do you make any, were there distinctions between them? Was it democracy activists versus, or you know, the rest? cost to the population. Who was the partner that had, or did you make distinctions in the partner that answered these questions or was defined as the partner that you were talking about in these relationships between the EU and the partner?
We were under such a time pressure that we had to find the proxy voices for whom could be partners, and therefore we approached the regional organizations based on the assumption that in this regard, and for the purposes of this project, the European Union is a regional organization. The counterparts would then be the OAS, African Union, ASEAN, League of Arab States, and SAARC. Now, these are not equal partners, we all know that, but these are proxy voices, and in the consultations we had officials from these institutions, plus civil society, plus academia, plus politicians, so it was a mixed audience, and they were selected on the basis of them knowing something about the subject matter. I think that people who would like to take this further are very welcome to do this, and they can go into refinement of a variety of categories of partners, but we simply did not have the time for that.
Last question, Ingrid, is do you think in general that people in Brussels will be reassured and happy with what if they read the report, or will they be perturbed and unhappy?
What do you think?
I can't speak for Brussels.
I think that it was interesting for us to invite people who represented all the various policy areas and the various institutions inside Brussels from the very first meeting in September 2008 and have them following the process. And now a year down the line, what we can see is that they are still coming to our meetings. They are still interested in talking to us. We clearly hit a note, which is something that many people think about, even if they think about it in different terms and they have different emphasis in what they consider challenges.
It's a very Swedish diplomatic answer. Thank you. Okay, thanks very much. Thank you very much. Let's give a round of applause for the hard work. if I could have my panelists come up and we'll arrange the chairs. I'm going to introduce the panel while they're arranging themselves on the podium. Next, we're going to be discussing taking some of these issues further, and I would like you right here, Vidar, there, and Pia, here, and Larry there. Right. We're going to proceed as follows. We have four great people up here. Maria Leissner is Sweden's ambassador for democracy. For those of you who don't know Maria, she's somebody who's been very active in democracy support for a couple of decades as a senior Swedish diplomat, but she's also worked with the National Democratic Institute and had quite a wide variety of experiences. She was Sweden's ambassador to Guatemala. She worked in Iraq for NDI. She's now Sweden's ambassador for democracy, so she's a formidable and talented figure in this field. She's going to talk a bit about the recent council conclusions that emerged from Brussels last week, their significance, and help us understand a bit better this process. I'm going to then turn to Pia Baumgarten here on my left. Pia is the Washington representative of the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. Before coming to Washington, which was fairly recently, Pia was serving in Germany at the headquarters of the Ebert Stiftung in a senior position in the international division there, and has other experience as well in the field on these matters. We also have with us, I'm going to ask Larry Garber to join the conversation. Larry, I think, is known to most of you. Again, another longtime activist and practitioner, as well as thinker and writer in the field of democracy support. Larry has worked at NDI for a number of years, and then USAID in various capacities, both in headquarters and as mission director in West Bank Gaza, and then more recently as president of the New Israel Fund, and has recently gone back into the hallowed halls of USAID as an expert consultant, and is there now and joins us. He'll be speaking in an informal and non-official capacity as Larry, rather than Larry as USAID, but he brings a wealth of governmental experience and as well as practical experience on the field of these issues. And last but not least, Vidar Helgason will also join the conversation. Vidar is Secretary General of International IDEA in Stockholm, and previously served as Norway's Deputy Foreign Minister and in a number of other positions in Norwegian officialdom. So Vidar, welcome as well. Maria, let's start off. Why don't you tell us, how should we understand what we heard in terms terms of these conclusions coming from Brussels last week, and what do they represent in terms of a larger process?
Well, actually, I'm really surprised. I'm so happy reading this, and I actually got it while on the trip here to Washington, because it was adopted only 3 days ago. It started out, actually, a couple of years ago when we had a number of different meetings where people from different countries and institutions in the European Union met to talk about democracy. I know that several of you in the audience here also were present at several of these occasions. And we discussed the problems with democracy support in general. There are several reasons why we needed to find a new start, a restart in Europe on this. And one is, of course, that the concept of democracy promotion had been tainted. And everything sort of stopped. It was really difficult for all of those who wanted to continue working with democracy support to do so because of the political resistance in countries that we cooperate with, as well as within our own administrations, when we need to find a way out. We needed to redefine what democracy support is about. And as you can hear, I'm not saying democracy promotion. Democracy support is where we landed in these council conclusions, finally, and I think that is precisely the slight little difference that we needed to make. Another reason was also that we thought that there was a possibility to revive this because of the problems with the war in Iraq. And there was a need for a different take on democracy support than the one that unfortunately had become the official picture of what democracy support was all about. A third argument for myself, my fellow Swedes, was that we had been asked by the Swedish Minister for Development 3 years, almost 3 years ago, to produce new guidelines for how to work with democracy support and human rights support in the Swedish Development Corporation. And we produced, and it was published about a year ago, Freedom from Oppression, which is, not having tables is difficult. this thing, Thomas Brundin worked a lot with this, and we were, many of us, putting in efforts. And I think that the take that we wanted to have was to get democracy and human rights to be an integral part of development. CEDA had already applied what we call the extended definition of poverty. Let me quote how we formulate this. As you know, we all, within Development Cooperation, we focus on poverty. But what is poverty? According to the definition of poverty that underpins Swedish Development Cooperation, poverty is not only about inadequate socioeconomic development and material security, it's also about lack of political power at individual level and the inability of citizens to influence decisions that affect their lives. So this was the framework where we put democracy and human rights within Development Cooperation. And this also gives a different meaning to what development is. What is development? Is development really only about social and economic conditions? Is it really just about one set of the human rights? Or is development possibly also about the political and civil rights? Maybe that is indeed an integral part of development. So we felt that we had something to put into this discussion. And since the Swedish presidency was coming up, many would turn to us and say, please, why don't you be the motor, the engine in this process? And we accepted. And it was really difficult because, and I'm under strict orders not to have any Euro speak here, so I'm not going to go into details. I just can tell you that it was quite tedious.
That's code word for unbelievably tedious.
And we did it. I can't believe it. Now, what you know, the European Union is a fantastic invention, and I love it, but we still have a few things to do. in order to make it efficient. Now, the Commission has a mandate to work with the development, and there has been very little political influence in how the Commission is working with development assistance. They're using our tax money, but that doesn't say that mean that we have any influence over it. The other parts of EU foreign policy are of the intergovernmental nature, so it's more governed by the different governments and also with a heavy influence from Parliament. So everything that has to do with foreign policy, security policy, election monitoring and everything else is done by other institutions, other people, and follow other rules. And still, democracy, supposedly, and democracy support is permeating everything that we do. We needed to pull all of this together so that the left hand knew what the right hand was doing. And another thing that I've been angry at during these two decades that you talk about, Tom, is that there is a very, very thick wall in between the human rights sector and the development sector. And we wanted to bridge that. One of the problems is that within the development sector, people are so afraid of politics. And they are so afraid of the D word. They don't even use democracy. You talk about governance or good governance or possibly at the very best democratic governance. On the other hand, sometimes there's too much politics on the human rights side. And we needed to find a common platform for how we want to work with democracy support, putting a little bit more politics into development and perhaps putting a more developmental perspective into the other parts of democracy support, including election monitoring and missions abroad, peace and conflict resolutions, missions, etc. So that is the basic reasons why we needed to have something done. Now, what came out of this is not just a, what is it, six pages long paper. It is actually something that will change the way that the European Union is working with democracy support and how we view development. First of all, there are a few things that are stated as principles that every one of you have used these words, of course, in your mouth. Democratic systems may vary in forms of shape. Democracy, however, has evolved into a universal value that is showing respect for the different shapes of democracy there is, but also saying that we now have a global shared value of democracy and human rights. So these things that are needed in order to create a balance compared to the picture, the image that we have of democracy support, you can find all of these things here, which is good and necessary. But on the practical side, the European Union is in every country where we have development cooperation going to analyze the democratic process, going to plan for how the European Union will support the democratic process. They are in this document, they have strict recommendations to not only involve governments, but also speak to all political actors, and political actors are especially pointed out, Parliament and other political actors, media, and the civil society. And this is also something new. They have to report back, the representations of the European Union have to report back on the progress, and visibility is very important. So you will see headings on democracy support and reports, etc. So this is going to change what we do on the ground. We will also have a few pilot countries, they are not really decided yet, for the increased cooperation between the different branches of the European Union's external action. Something that is quite interesting is also what Ingrid has been talking about, and that is the regional aspect. We are going to explore possibilities to set up inter-regional platforms for exchange on democracy and how we can support one another and learn from one another in this field. So it is actually going to be a document, not only a nice speech type of document, but it's going to be used in reality. I'm incredibly pleased. There are a number of things where I think there is still room for improvement. But several of the ambitions that we have, most of them actually, are met with.
A couple of questions to start, and then I want to get questions from you, and we're going to move ahead as well. Are these conclusions, this is just to help an American American audience that doesn't always understand the complexities of European policies with respect to the relationship between Brussels and national government policies? These conclusions are designed to be a framework for European Union policy, or are national governments supposed to also refer to them and integrate them into their own national government policy?
It's primarily European Union policy. Mm-hmm. But of course, I think that they are indirectly going to affect mm-hmm. how every country mm-hmm. is going to work with it.
Second less diplomatic question is, what was difficult about arriving at the conclusions? Was it simply disagreements over language and nuance, or was it that there were some member states, which I assume would remain unnamed, that didn't really like the idea of doing this all together?
The most difficult was the institutional cultures. Mm-hmm. Making people in Brussels talk to one another.
Completely unknown here in this city.
Yeah. Yeah, our government operates in a much more seamless fashion. But talk to each other, but are you implying that once they started talking to each other, it wasn't that hard to agree on substance?
Well, I'm not sure that they quite agreed on substance yet, but they had to. We were told by everyone it would be absolutely impossible to make the different institutions of the European Union actually come together and produce, which they did, one single background paper. Mm-hmm. They did. It was not impossible. We were told it was going to be impossible.
Yeah.
Some people on the development side were making a lot of noises about, well, this means that you want to politicize development assistance. You are going to put more conditionality into aid. Mm. And so it's written into the paper, we are not putting more conditionality into development assistance. Fine. I'm not sure they believe it still, but it's there. Mm-hmm. But now, today, with this document, all I hear is people singing, really. And I still cannot believe how it's possible, but it seems that all the different actors in the different institutions actually are quite pleased with what came out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think one thing that's striking to U.S. policy community is that, you know, the United States would rarely put forward a policy document trying to articulate its policy. Policy documents in the United States are often speeches. You know, a president gives a speech and sets out ideas about how the United States will promote democracy. But attempting to elaborate, you know, a six-page statement of principles and practices on democracy is something I can remember having been done for a while. Now, it's done sometimes, the aid agency might do it specifically, like a framework for this. But it's a bit unusual, and it's partly because you have many governments that are working together. Do you think if you handed this to somebody in the Obama administration and said, why don't you just adopt these as mm-hmm. your principles, is there anything in here that a U.S. policymaker would read and say, no, sorry, we part company here?
No, on the opposite. I think that this serves very well as an inspiration for the Obama administration. I think that I understand the situation, the complicated situation the Obama administration has right now. They need to keep a distance to the Bush administration. They need to find a new way of dealing with democracy support mm-hmm. without necessarily continuing the legacy, but still continue doing something mm-hmm. worthwhile and good when it comes to democracy support. And it seems they do not yet know how to do that. Mm-hmm. I think we have part of the answer. Mm-hmm. We have part of the answer because we say that you need to widen the concept of democracy to also include the delivery aspects, as Inge mm-hmm. was saying. Mm-hmm. We may want to look at a broader concept of development, and I think this is one answer on how to go forward to make democracy support more developmental in approach, and perhaps not as overly political as it has been
right.
interpreted.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that the respect, the humility part that we learned in our process, which is one of the things that I carry with me from the international ideas process, is perhaps an even more important way forward. And I think that you already are discovering that. I was listening to Undersecretary Posner this Monday in Brussels during a Community of Democracy event, and he was speaking in a very interesting way that I really liked about how do you gain credibility if you want to do democracy support, well, you have to clean up your own backyard first. And then he was talking about Guantanamo, about lead by example. Mm-hmm. And this is precisely what we learned from the process of the interregional dialogue that mm-hmm. International Idea led. When we were talking about the necessity for us to listen, that we are all countries, we have our own problems that we need to deal with, and particularly from my personal point of view, I see a number of things that we need to do, not only in the European Union, but also in Sweden. I'm talking about inclusion of the Roma minority of 12 million people, of whom very many never participate in elections and even less in politics. I mean, number of things that we need mm-hmm. to do. And just having that attitude that mm-hmm. we have shared values, that we want to get to real partnership, that we want to get away from the colonial attitude, and that we need to learn from each other's experiences, and we don't always have the only answer. That attitude, I think, mm-hmm. is something that we may develop together.
Thanks very much. Okay, I want to bring into the conversation Pia Baumgarten. Pia, you've worked, when some people think of European democracy support, I would say that the German political foundations, being among the most, in a sense, historic, and as well as large institutions working in this area, represent certain traditions and approaches that really embody many elements of European democracy support. So your background and your position at ABERT give you some perspective on this. And I'm curious when you reflect, at the same time you're very familiar with the United States and you've lived here before and you have exposure to American both culture and our policy community. If I ask you the question and say, it is a puzzle, US and European democracy support, there is some sense of differences. But I think there's a lack of clarity in many people's mind. Are those differences really ones more of style? Are they more differences of kind of methods? Or are they really differences in goals? What is it that we feel is separating us? I wonder if you could reflect on that a bit. Yeah.
Thanks very much, Tom. I'm very grateful to be here and be able to participate. Mm-hmm. I think some of these differences in style that kind of come and go, because I agree with the point you made earlier that in the 90s, there was a sense of convergence. Mm. I, at that point, was working in Thailand, and we worked very closely with our colleagues from NDI, and I actually think that this kind of coming together in the field continued. There was great willingness to participate in each other's events, to be on good terms, to exchange information, and so on. But I think that, and also, with regard to overall approach, as when it comes to values, to expectations, I think the Now let me narrow it to what I know best. the German foundations and the U.S., our U.S. counterparts, our U.S. Colleagues, there is, I think, no difference. We have similar reasons for why we want to be involved in this, and we have similar hopes mm-hmm. what it might contribute to if you look at the official European documents as well. This is a continuum. But I think in the last couple of years, for all the reasons that have already been mm-hmm. Referred to, we had experiences where we did come for a moment to the conclusion that there were differences in methodology, in approach, in assumptions. And I can list some of those. And I would say that one of the key things that we need and we should have had more of and kind of ran out of, where we had did not any longer have really good fora for discussing this, where we could talk to each other openly, not necessarily publicly, mm-hmm. but really exchange experiences, and where we could have raised issues like this. I did a meeting like this in May of 2006 with our colleagues from NDI and IRI and all the German foundations, and it was an incredibly productive meeting because I think what has been said before, perceptions are incredibly important, and some of these perceptions lag way behind realities, so people assume that they know certain things or they take a particular example and, believe that is, not mm-hmm. just an example, but it's representative of, and so I think this kind of continuous dialogue is essential, and I think we no longer had good fora for it. We did have for a while into the earlier mm-hmm. part of this decade, but I think what we had was a meeting where every year we would meet at a different foundation, and I came into this process relatively late, and my perception was people regarded it as meaningless, because people would just list, we're doing this and that, and it was too abstract, mm-hmm. it was too large, mm-hmm. And then, for a variety of reasons, different processes started. And as mm-hmm. The European political foundations now have, for the very first time, an umbrella organization of sorts, ENOP, European Network of Political Foundations. And so a lot of effort went into this. And for a while, there was a real lack of constructive debate, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think we very urgently need to do this. When I was still in Berlin in May, I tried to set up a meeting like this, and unfortunately it didn't work, because I do believe that we need to have a continuous discussion so we can discuss things like methods. I do believe there are some differences in method, and they have to some extent to do with the question of delivery aspect. You know, the German political foundations, all of them, regardless of what political party they are associated with, have always emphasized questions of development and social policy, always. You know, to us, that's very closely linked to the whole question of democracy support. There are some differences, I believe, we will not necessarily be able to put aside, because we are institutions that come from a European country, a middle-sized power. We do approach certain things because of that. This is something that I remember running into in the context of Central Asia, where our perception was that American institutions were more likely to assume, to concentrate on a bottom-up approach, and believing that they could put increasing pressures on authoritarian governments, and that's valid, you know. The German foundations were much more likely to combine a bottom-up and a top-down approach, you know, believing in a multi-stakeholder process. And we found ourselves sometimes between a rock and a hard place, you know, accused of stabilizing regimes that were criticized. And we realized, you know, we come from middle-sized powers. We believe in dialogue. We believe in round tables, partly because of our European experience. Our American counterparts were more able and more convinced that they could mold certain conditions, and we simply did not share that perspective.
Does that mean that when you view the concept of convergence now, rather than two roads that have been apart that are meeting in the middle, I mean, I think if my colleague Bob Kagan at Carnegie were listening to you, he'd say, oh, I see what convergence is the Obama administration wants to be a middle-sized power, and so we're accepting the idea that you can't push other countries too hard. We're going to take a very developmental consideration. You Europeans just have kept going down your road. We're joining you over on your road. Do you think there's a feeling in some European institutions that at last the Americans have, you know, sort of woken up and are joining us, not that we're sort of converging, but rather they're merging?
Possibly, but you know, there's always a danger of that being a misconception too, which is why it's so urgent to have a reliable forum where you can continuously, you know, update your understanding of what people are really thinking, you know, because people do bring different and valid different experience to the to a table like this. I think one of the issues that for the German foundations is of particular interest, for example, and that's where I think there is not a particular correct take on any side. You know, there are different experiences. It's the question of what's the role of international institutions? What's the role of the EU? What's the role of national governments? And what's the role of non-governmental organizations? And you know, that would be incredibly important to discuss, because I think there are situations where certain things can only be done by the EU or only be done by government. But then there are also situations when it makes much more sense to have clearly independent organizations working. You may remember the interesting case of the British diplomats expelled from Russia in January 2006, and because they had been involved in directly funding, they were expelled by the Russians. And there was an interesting article by Timothy Garton Ash then talking about the fact that if you are involved with frontline democracy promotion, independence of the institutions is incredibly important. He says you should not only be like Caesar's wife, you know, so not only above suspicion, but be seen as being above suspicion. That's to me a very interesting issue, because this is an evolving field. How do you best combine what only in an international context can be supported, where very important policies and messages are sent? What should governments do? Because like the government of Kenya, for example, approached the German government for support. Only the German government could do certain things. No German individual institution like the Friedrich Ebert Foundation. And then there are things that are best left to independent institutions, which was one of the difficulties we had with during the previous administration, because I still remember very closely talking to American colleagues, and they talked about the way in which what non-governmental institutions were doing and what the US government was doing. It was a seamless package.
Uh-huh.
And that was, I think, from our perspective and our experience, that was something we were very uncomfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole way of combining in the best way what different actors bring into this common effort, I think would be one of the mm-hmm. important debates.
Great. Larry, I'd like to turn to you. We'll hear more from Maria and Pia, but as you hear both Maria and Pia talk about this question of both European movement on this and the question of whether there are really significant differences or on that, both from your experience in the 1990s when you were at USAID in Washington and then in the field in West Bank Gaza, where actually West Bank Gaza is quite an interesting arena of US-European cooperation in that both the United States and Europe are very substantial assistance actors there with, in a broad sense, similar goals, but of course different political bases at home and different methods of operating. How does some of this sound to you? And as you're back in sitting in governmental hallways or walking in them now, sitting in governmental offices, and we're returning to this question of, you know, is there a new moment for US-European cooperation? What are some of your thoughts about this right now?
Thanks, Tom, and it's also a privilege and pleasure to be here and to be engaged in this discussion. When I was listening to Pia, I was thinking back to sort of when I first got involved and working at NDI in the early mid-1980s. And our model at that time was the German Stiftungs. I mean, that's what we thought we were emulating. And then I think there was a divergence where we started doing things that the Stiftungs hadn't done. And then there was sort of a reconvergence perhaps several years later. And the same experience in terms of working in the development field. When I came to AID in 1993, one of our goals was to introduce the word, the terminology of democracy into the development portfolio. And we were very conscious about it. We were very sensitive that words do matter. And I remember going to participate in meetings then of the Development Assistance Committee's working group that was supposed to be the counterpart to this and discovered that it was called something like Participatory Development and Good Governance. And there was a real resistance to our efforts to introduce the word democracy at the time. And again, reflecting a real development orientation and nervousness about, you know, what democracy meant along the lines of what both Maria and Pia are talking about. And so it's, you know, quite interesting to me to come back, you know, again in 2009 and to see the Europeans this time being very forward-looking and forthright about using the term democracy in their development orientations. And they're wondering about where we are on this issue. So again,
that's called progress.
That's called, I think, evolution. Yeah. And that's you know, that's what's happened. At one level, I'm you know, as I said, I think words matter, and I think it is interesting, and I think worth reflection on the choice of the term democracy support. Particularly as you counterposed it to democracy promotion. Because I think at the end of the day, you know, we need to think about what the practical implications are of policy-type documents. And contrary to what you said, Tom, I mean, I think the United States does produce a lot of policy documents.
I guess they just don't read them, yeah.
Right, we produce every year a national security strategy. And if you read it, you'll see lots of references to these notions. But the real question is what impact it has on the bureaucracy and you know, how do people apply these notions. And you know, we often do make policy in a broad sense through presidential speeches. And again, you can go review those and see what some of the directions of this administration are. But I'm you know, skeptical, Maria, in terms of, you know, the application of the democracy support or democracy promotion to the bureaucracy. And I think, you know, there are going to be tensions that you may have smoothed over in terms of getting a document past what I, you know, congratulate you on was, I'm sure, a very difficult process. But, you know, even the words that are used in the document, I think, reflect some of the tensions. And I think they're real tensions when we talk about this at the level in which policy implementers need to think about them. So when we talk about the principle, the development principle of local ownership or country ownership, which is well embedded into the development sector, and how does that come up against the notion that we believe that democracy do provide the types of settings in which development can best take place? We're not neutral about this issue. We do have a concept in our mind about what this means. And even the use of the term, you know, broad understanding of democracy. I mean, to me, that sounds like a bit of a, you know, a cop-out. I mean, you know, how broad is the understanding of democracy? I mean, is it cover everything that goes from, you know, what used to call people's democracies to you know, sort of multi-party democracies? I think we need to be sensitive because there are implications of this for the implementer. And I think, you know, for me, you know, the tension comes most obviously when you do talk about, you know, what types of partners are we looking for? And the paper is very clear. It specifically says we're not looking to impose conditionalities. But what are we going to impose? What are we prepared to impose in the context of promoting or advocating for democracy?
Just slipped out there, that word.
Right. Or advocating for democracy. And last point I'll make right now is again, I think from the development perspective, the sort of modest and humble approach is very important. But we often work in very different environments that imply that have different implications. And we need to be aware that there's not this sort of pure model of democracy, of development, that can be applied in every setting. In many cases, you know, for better or worse, we're working in environments that involve other interests, national security interests for the United States and for Europe. And those do impact on the types of programs that we develop or implement, both from a development and a democracy perspective, where we have global interests. I mean, we're all talking now about global climate change in the weeks before the meeting in Copenhagen. What types of assistance are we providing, and how does the democracy support play out in those settings? Is it different from the types of settings where we're focused on poverty alleviation and the like? So I think there are a lot of nuances that are required to be developed before the practical applications of what I think is a very important document can be fully appreciated.
Larry, you raised some important points, and I appreciate that. I think you've stirred Murray up to a response. And so, Murray, and then I want to bring Vidar in and just get his thoughts on how this looks to him.
Well, maybe, Larry, that for the sake of the debate, you wanted to attack the broader definition of democracy. Let me say that...
It's a dialogue, not a debate. It's very different. Yeah.
For the sake of the dialogue, right? I just want to clarify that it's not a watering down of the concept of democracy, and it does not mean that you would find the European Union standing behind Chavez's definition of what democracy is. That's not going to happen. Let me just read one sentence, the first sentence from the EU Agenda for Action on Democracy Support. Democratic and participatory governance and the free will of the people can best assure the right of men and women to live and raise their children in dignity, freedom from hunger, and from the fear of violence, oppression, or injustice. That is the link between freedom and development that we want to make in this document.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no? Vidar, let's have some additional thoughts.
Don't forget to tell that Maria is a former politician.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Vidar, how does this, when you hear, you're, in a sense, international ideas, an interesting position in Europe that you're, you're a multilateral organization with members from many different parts of the world, yet you yourself are European, you've worked as a European diplomat, and I think international idea being located in Europe has a certain center of gravity among in European thinking about these issues, yet you're outside these structures and you're not a direct participant in them. And so both, you know, if you have any reflections on this and on this general question that I asked Pia of where do you feel, are we really at a moment of convergence? And if it is convergence, what shape is it taking?
Not sure where to start, but maybe I should start by giving another kind of response to Larry, because your point about the proof of the pudding, if I may, is a correct one. I mean, the document is actually an achievement, but it's not the end game. And Sweden has taken impressive leadership on this issue, but there are other European governments that might not be as forward-leaning on this approach. So there's a lot of that remains to be seen. But Larry mentioned, as a dilemma, the principle of local ownership. How do you reconcile that with democracy and the insistence on democracy? And that actually brings me to what I see as a risk of divergence rather than convergence. I think the question is whose ownership? Development assistance has a tradition, even when talking of local ownership, of engaging with the executive branch of government and then do some civil society activity on the sidelines, and then leaving political work to party assistance, foundations, and some dropping some election observation missions occasionally. But what development cooperation often doesn't deal with is political processes and political actors. So ownership shouldn't mean the ownership of the Ministry of Finance or the president of a country only. It should mean the full political community. And that's where political parties and parliaments come in. Because if you are to strengthen democracy, you need to work with the hub of democracy, and that is actually the parliament and the political parties. And I see traditionally development assistance has been reluctant on this part. The political foundations and others working on democracy have on their part been quite reluctant to engaging in the development debate about measuring quality, evaluation, etc. They've been quite happy being a bit away from the development community. And I see this changing slowly in Europe. And the Council conclusions are actually taking that forward. There is a realization that democracy and development need to interact, and democracy and development assistance need to interact. Is this happening in the US? I'm not so sure. Judging from discussions I've observed on the review now going on the development policies in the US, I'm not so sure that this dimension is captured. I see some signals pointing in a fairly technocratic, traditionalist approach to development. So in this sense, I think these European Council conclusions could and definitely should be an inspiration in the US process. Otherwise, there might be a divergence more than a convergence on this issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just a short information from me. I think the fact that we, as German political foundations, have focused on assistance to political parties and so on, that's an element of our work, but it really isn't the whole. The division in the Ebert Foundation that does the democracy promotion or democracy support in Africa, Asia, Latin America is called the Division for International Development Cooperation. And so we have actually really for quite a long period of time now always tried to think democracy support and development together. That's what I was trying to say earlier, that as far as the whole question of delivery, economic and social policy are key. And when I was in Thailand, for example, my key work was in the beginning on sort of working with various partners on the new Thai constitution. That was rather political, have to do directly with Thai democracy, but the big work was on occupational health and safety, question of social reform. So I think it would be interesting to engage on this, because I think the German political foundations actually have a long history, now decades in some ways of history, in bringing the whole question of political work and the question of economic and social development, bring that together as we do our work on the ground in mm-hmm. around the world.
Larry, any comments? Then I'm going to turn to the audience next. So if you have questions or comments, you may want to start.
To react to what was said, I mean, I think most people in this audience know what is referred to in terms of the policy reviews that are underway, both led by the National Security Council, called the PSD, Presidential Study Directive, and the quadrennial diplomacy and development review, that's both of which are underway, and I think it would be premature to draw judgments about where they're going to end up, particularly on this issue. And there's a lot of time and work that still will go into it. We're generally much more impatient. The three-year process doesn't work well here, but it's not 1 month either, so it will take some time. And so now we have mostly, you know, the speeches of our senior officials to go on, including the president, including the secretary of state. You know, and again, I urge folks to read them, because I think on these issues, particularly the Cairo speech that President Obama delivered, and the Moscow speech, but also the speech in Ghana and Accra, where he talks very much along the same lines. I don't think you'd find any divergence between what President Obama said and what's in the European paper here. So in that sense, I think it's one indication, but there are other, you know, issues that certainly are germane here. The other issue that I think is important that this administration clearly has spoken to relates to the whole question of seeking to converge with other countries and other, particularly allies, on these types of issues. So there is a real effort and desire to engage multilaterally and to try to come up with common positions on a whole broad range of issues, but I think including development principles and regarding the issue of democracy. So I think the table has been set, but clearly there's a lot more work that's going to go on in the context of these reviews, and hopefully in a few months we'll have a clearer sense of some type of public policy document that will reflect, you know, the principles that we're talking about.
I'd like to turn to questions and comments, and this is intended to be a conversation, and so if you just have a comment you want to make, go ahead and make your comment. Don't have to dress up as a question. I know you have in mind. I've got lots of people here. Let me start in the back, then I'll work up towards the front, then I'll come over here. Yep. Right there in the back row. Yep, right there.
Michael Allen with the National Endowment for Democracy.
A little bit louder, Mike.
Michael Allen with the National Endowment for Democracy. Firstly, let me thank the panel for a very rich and informative and engaging discussion on the policies and the principles and indeed the discourse of democracy support. And I hope you'll forgive me if I drag the discussion down a few notches to a kind of mundane, practical level. I suppose this question is primarily addressed to Maria. What do these conclusions, what does this shift, this new policy mean in practical terms for an NGO in Belarus or a democracy activist in Egypt? And in particular, does it have any implications whatsoever for the issue that's always referred to when we talk about EU democracy assistance, which is the opacity, the impenetrability of EU funding mechanisms? And if I can add a second one onto that, what does it mean in practical terms? Is it pushing the things too far to move from talking about convergence to collaboration or cooperation? Because everybody in this room, I'm sure, is aware of the gross waste and duplication of effort that both EU and US democracy assistance practitioners see in the field, or is that too much to hope for?
Well, those are big questions, Mike. Why don't you take at least the first one, and then I was actually hoping to save a little bit of time to come to the question of from convergence to actual cooperation. So why don't you take the first question about the significance of these, and Mike will come back to the second part of your question.
The Commission will start acting in a different way on the ground, and that is the most interesting thing with these Council conclusions, and I had not even had that high hopes for it, so I'm really pleased. What is going to happen on the ground in countries like the ones you mentioned is that the EU representatives and the EU cooperation will seek a different type of cooperation and dialogue with all the political actors, and they will not only focus on government-to-government support, they will take into account other political